of the consul's hawking mat. I had lost the real mat on Mare Infinitus many years before, and the details of how it came back to me still lie ahead in my tale. I had given the actual hawking mat to Abetic, but it must have amused my torturers to finish my final cell with this useless copy of a flying carpet. So they had allowed me my clothes, the fake hawking mat and the palm-sized disky journal I had taken from the ship on Tian Shan. The comm unit element of the journal had been disabled. Not that it would broadcast through the energy shell of the Schrodinger box, or that there was anyone for me to call, but the journal memory, after their careful study of it during my Inquisition trial, had been left intact. It was on Tian Shan that I had begun making notes and daily journal entries. It was these notes that I had brought up onto the scriber screen in the Schrodinger cat box, reviewing them before writing this most personal of sections. And it was the immediacy in the notes, I believe, that led me to use the present tense narrative. All of my memories of Anea are vivid, but some of the memories brought back by these hurried entries at the end of a long day of work, or adventure, on Tian Shan, were so vital as to make me weep with renewed loss. I relived those moments as I wrote those words. And some of her discussion groups were recorded verbatim on the Disky Journal. I played those during my last days just to hear Aeneas' soft voice once again. "Tell us about the Technocore," one of the monks requests during the discussion hour this night of the Pax's arrival. "Please, tell us about the core." Anea hesitates only an instant, bowing her head slightly as if ordering her thoughts. "Once upon a time," she begins. She always begins her long explanations this way. "Once upon a time," says Anea, "more than 1,000 standard years ago, before the Hegira, before the big mistake of 08, the only autonomous intelligences we humans knew of were us humans. We thought then that if humankind ever devised another intelligence, that it would be the result of a huge project, a great mass of silicon and ancient amplification, switching and detection devices called transistors and chips and circuit boards, a machine with lots of networking circuits. In other words, aping, if you will pardon the expression, the human brain in form and function. Of course, AIs did not evolve that way. They sort of slipped into existence when we humans were looking the other way. You have to imagine now, an old Earth before humankind had off-world colonies. No Hawking drive, no interplanetary flight to speak of. All of our eggs were literally in one carton. And that carton was the lovely blue and white water world of old Earth. By the end of the 20th century Christian era, this little world had a crude datasphere. Basic planetary telecommunication had evolved into a decentralized swarm system of old silicon-based computers demanding no organization or hierarchy, demanding nothing beyond a common communications protocol. Creation of a distributed memory hive mind was then inevitable. The earliest lineal ancestors to today's core personalities were not projects to create artificial intelligence, but incidental efforts to simulate artificial life. In the 1940s, the great-grandfather of the Technocore, a mathematician named John von Neumann, had done all the proofs of artificial self-replication. As soon as the early silicon-based computers became small enough for individuals to play with, curious amateurs began practicing synthetic biology within the confines of these machines' CPU cycles. Hyperlife, self-reproducing, information-storing, interacting, metabolizing, evolving, came into existence in the 1960s. It escaped the tide pools of the individual machines in the last decade of that century, moving into the embryonic planetary datasphere that they called the Internet or the Web. The earliest AIs were dumb as dirt, or perhaps the better metaphor would be that they were as dumb as early cellular life that was in the dirt, some of the earliest hypercritters floating in the warm medium of the datasphere, which was also evolving, were 80-byte organisms inserted into a block of RAM in a virtual computer, a computer simulated by a computer. One of the first humans to release such creatures into the datasphere ocean was named Tom Ray, and he was not an AI expert or computer programmer or cyberpuke, which they called hackers then, but was a biologist, an insect collector, botanist, and birdwatcher, and someone who had spent years collecting ants in the jungle for a pre-Hajira scientist named E.O. Wilson. Watching ants, Tom Ray became interested in evolution, and wondered if he could not just simulate evolution in one of the early computers, but create real evolution there. None of the cyberpukes he spoke with were interested in the idea, so he taught himself computer programming. The cyberpuke said that evolving and mutating code sequences happened all the time in computers. They were called bugs and screwed-up programs. They said that if his code sequences evolved into something else, they would almost certainly be non-functional, non-viable, as most mutations are, and would just foul up the operation of the computer software. So Tom Ray created a virtual computer, a simulated computer within his real computer, for his code-sequenced creations. And then he created an actual 80-byte code-sequence creature that could reproduce, die, and evolve in his computer within a computer. The 80-byte copied itself into more 80-bytes. These 80-byte proto-AI cell things would have quickly filled their virtual universe, like pond scum on top of pond scum in an Elysium early Earth. But Tom Ray gave each 80-byte a date tag, gave them age, in other words, and programmed in an executioner that he called the Reaper. The Reaper wandered through this virtual universe and harvested old 80-byte critters and non-viable mutants. But evolution, as it is wont to do, tried to outsmart the Reaper. A mutant 79-byte creature proved not only to be viable, but soon outbred and outpaced the 80-bytes. The hyperlifes, ancestors to our core AIs, were just born, but already they were optimizing their genomes. Soon a 45-byte organism had evolved and all but eliminated the earlier artificial life forms. As their creator, Tom Ray found this odd. 45-bytes did not include enough code to allow for reproduction. More than that, the 45s were dying off as the 80s disappeared. He did an autopsy on one of the 45 creatures. It turned out that all of the 45-bytes were parasites. They borrowed needed reproductive code from the 80s to copy themselves. The 79s, it turned out, were immune to the 45 parasite. But as the 80s and 45s moved toward extinction in their co-evolutionary downward spiral, a mutant of the 45s appeared. It was a 51-byte parasite, and it could prey on the vital 79s. And so it went. I mention all this because it is important to understand that from the very first appearance of human-created artificial life and intelligence, such life was parasitic. It was more than parasitic, it was hyper-parasitic. Each new mutation led to parasites which could prey on earlier parasites. Within a few billion generations, that is to say CPU cycles, this artificial life had become hyper-hyper-hyper-parasitic. Within standard months of his creation of hyperlife, Tom Ray discovered 22-byte creatures flourishing in his virtual medium. Creatures so algorithmically efficient that when challenged by Tom Ray, human programmers could create nothing closer than a 31-byte version. Only months after their creation, hyperlife creatures had evolved an efficiency that their creators could not match. By the early 21st century, there was a thriving biosphere of artificial life on old Earth, both in the quickly evolving datasphere and in the macrosphere of human life. Although the breakthroughs of DNA computing, bubble memories, standing wavefront parallel processing, and hyper-networking were just being explored, human designers had created silicon-based entities of remarkable ingenuity, and they had created them by the billions. Microchips were in everything from chairs to cans of beans on store shelves to ground cars to artificial human body parts. The machines had grown smaller and smaller until the average human home or office was filled with tens of thousands of them. A worker's chair would recognize her as soon as she sat, bring up the file she had been working on in her crude silicon computer, chat with another chip in a coffee maker to heat up the coffee, enable the telecommunications grid to deal with calls and faxes and crude electronic mail arrivals so that the worker would not be disturbed, interact with the main house or office computer so that the temperature was optimal, and so forth. In their stores, microchips in the cans of beans on the shelves noted their own price and price changes, ordered more of themselves when they were running short, kept track of the consumer's buying habits, and interacted with the store and the other commodities in it. This web of interaction became as complex and busy as the bubble and froth of old Earth's organic stew in its early oceans. Within 40 years of Tom Ray's 80-byte a cell, humans were accustomed to talking to and otherwise interacting with the countless artificial life forms in their cars, their offices, their elevators, even in their bodies, as medical monitors and proto-shunts moved toward true nanotechnology. The Technocore came into autonomous being sometime during this period. Humanity had understood, quite correctly as it turned out, that for artificial life and artificial intelligence to be effective, it must be autonomous. It must evolve and diversify, much as organic life had on the planet. And it did so, as well as the biosphere surrounding the planet. Hyperlife now wrapped the world in a living datasphere. The core evolved not just as an abstract entity within the information flow of the web datasphere, but among the interactions of a billion tiny, autonomous, chip-driven micro-machines carrying out their mundane tasks in the human macro-world. Humanity and the billion-faceted, evolving core entity soon became as symbiotic as acacia plants and the marauding ants that protect, prune, and propagate the acacia as their sole food source. This is known as coevolution, and humans understand the concept on a truly cellular level, since so much of organic life on Earth had been created and optimized by the reciprocal co-evolutionary dance. But where human beings saw a comfortable symbiosis, the early AI entities saw, were capable of seeing, only new opportunities for parasitism. Computers might be turned off, software programs might be terminated, but the hive mind of the proto-core had already moved into the emerging datasphere, and that could be turned off only by planetary catastrophe. The core eventually provided that catastrophe in the big mistake of 08, but not before it had diversified its own medium and moved beyond a mere planetary scale. Early experiments in the Hawking Drive, conducted and understood only by advanced core elements, had revealed the existence of the underlying Planck space reality of the void which binds. Core AIs of the day, DNA-based waveform in structure, driven by genetic algorithms parallel in function, completed the construction of the early Hawking Drive ships and began design of the Farcaster network. Human beings always saw the Hawking Drive as a shortcut through time and space, a realization of their old hyperdrive dreams. They conceptualized Farcaster portals as convenient holes punched through space-time. This was the human preconception, borne out by their own mathematical models, and confirmed by the most powerful core computing AIs. It was all a lie. Planck space, the void which binds, is a multidimensional medium with its own reality and, as the core was soon to learn, its own topography. The Hawking Drive was not and is not a drive at all in the classic sense, but an entry device which touches on Planck space topography just long enough to change coordinates in the four-dimensional space-time continuum. Farcaster portals, on the other hand, allow actual entry to the void which binds medium. To humans, the reality was obvious. Step through a hole in space-time here. Exit instantaneously via another Farcaster hole there. My Uncle Martin had a Farcaster home with adjoining rooms on dozens of different worlds. Farcasters created the hegemony's world web. Another invention, the Fat Line, a faster-than-light communications medium, allowed for instantaneous communication between star systems. All the prerequisites for an interstellar society had been met. But the Corps did not perfect the Hawking drive, the Farcaster, and the Fatline for human convenience. Indeed, the Corps never perfected anything in their dealings with the Void Which Binds. The Corps knew from the beginning that the Hawking drive was little more than a failed attempt to enter Planck space. Driving spacecraft via Hawking drive was comparable, they knew, to moving an ocean-going vessel by setting off a series of explosions at its stern and riding the waves. Crudely effective, but wildly inefficient. They knew that despite all appearances to the contrary, and despite their claims of having created them, there were not millions of Farcaster portals during the height of the World Web. Only one. All Farcaster portals were actually a single entry door to Planck space, manipulated across space-time to provide the functioning illusion of so many doors. If the Corps had attempted to explain the truth to humanity, they might have used the analogy of a flashlight beam being rapidly flashed around a closed room. There were not many sources of light, only one in rapid transition. But they never bothered to explain this. In truth, they have kept the secret to this day. And the Corps knew that the topography of the Void Which Binds could be modulated to transit information instantaneously via the Fatline. But that this was a clumsy and destructive use of the medium of Planck space, rather like communicating across a continent by means of artificially produced earthquakes. But it offered this Fatline service to humanity without ever explaining it, because it served their purpose to do so. They had their own plans for the Planck space medium. What the Corps realized in their earliest experiments was that the Void Which Binds was the perfect medium for their own existence. No longer would they have to depend upon electromagnetic communication, or tight beam, or even modulated neutrino broadcast for their datasphere networks. No longer would they need human beings or robot probes to travel to the stars to expand the physical parameters of that network. By simply moving the primary elements of the core into the Void Which Binds, the AIs would have a safe hiding place from their organic rivals. A hiding place which was at once nowhere and everywhere. It was during this migration of the Corps personae from human-based dataspheres to the Void Which Binds megasphere that the Corps discovered that Planck space was not an empty universe. Behind its metadimensional hills and deep in its folded quantum space arroyos lurked something different, someone different. There were intelligences there. The Corps probed and then recoiled in awe and terror at the potential power of these others. These were the lions and tigers and bears spoken of by Uman, the Corps persona who claimed to have created and killed my father. The Corps' retreat had been so hasty, its reconnaissance into the Planck space universe so incomplete, that it had no idea where in real space-time these lions and tigers and bears dwelt, or if they existed in real time at all. Nor could the Corps AIs identify the others as having evolved from organic life, as humanity had done, or from artificial life, as they had. But the briefest glimpse had shown them that these others could manipulate time and space with the ease that human beings had once manipulated steel and iron. Such power was beyond comprehension. The Corps' reaction was pure and immediate retreat. This discovery and panic happened just as the Corps had initiated the action of destroying old Earth. My Uncle Martin's poem sings of how it was the Corps that arranged the big mistake of 08, the Kiev group's accidental dropping of a black hole into the guts of old Earth. But his poem does not tell, because he did not know, of the Corps' panic at the discovery of the lions and tigers and bears, and how they rushed to stop their planned destruction of old Earth. It was not easy to scoop a growing black hole out of the core of the collapsing planet, but the Corps designed a means and set about doing it in haste. Then, the home planet disappeared, not destroyed as it seemed to the humans, not saved as the Corps had hoped. Just gone. The Corps knew that the lions and tigers and bears had to be the ones who took the Earth, but as to how and to where and for what reason they had no clue. They computed the amount of energy necessary to forecast an entire planet away, and again they began quaking in their hyper-life boots. Such intelligences could explode the core of an entire galaxy to use as an energy source as easily as humans could light a campfire on a cold night. The core entities shit hyperlife bricks in their fear. I should back up here to explain the reasons for the core's decision to destroy Earth and their subsequent attempt to save it. The reasons go back to Tom Ray's 80-byte RAM creatures. As I explained, the life and intelligence which evolved in the datasphere medium knew no other form of evolution than parasitism, hyperparasitism, and hyper-hyper-hyper-hyperparasitism. But the core was aware of the shortcomings of absolute parasitism and knew that the only way it could grow beyond parasite status and parasite psychology was to evolve in response to the physical universe. That is, to have physical bodies as well as abstract core personae. The core had multiple sensory inputs and could create neural networks. But what it required for non-parasitic evolution was a constant and coordinated system of neural feedback circuits. That is, eyes, ears, tongues, limbs, fingers, toes, bodies. The core created cybrids for that purpose. Bodies grown from human DNA but connected to their core-based personae via fat line. But cybrids were difficult to monitor and became aliens when put down in a human landscape. Cybrids would never be comfortable on worlds inhabited by billions of organically evolved human beings. So the core made its early plans to destroy old Earth and thin out the human race by a factor of 90%. The core did have plans for incorporating the surviving elements of the human race into their cybrid-inhabited universe after the death of old Earth, using them as spare DNA stock and slave labor, much as we used androids. But the discovery of lions and tigers and bears and the panicked retreat from Planck space complicated those plans. Until the threat of these others was assessed and eliminated, the core would have to continue its parasitic relationship with humanity. It devised the Farcasters in the old world web just for that purpose. To humans, the trip through the Farcaster medium was instantaneous. But in the timeless topography of Planck space, the subjective dwell time there could be as long as the core wished. The core tapped into billions of human brains during that period, using human minds millions of times each standard day, to create a huge neural network for their own computing purposes. Every time a human stepped through a Farcaster portal, it was as if the core cut open that person's skull, removed the gray matter, laid the brain out on a workbench, and hooked it up to billions of other brains in their giant, parallel-processing, organic computer. The humans completed their step from Planck space in a subjective instant of their time and never noticed the inconvenience. Uman told my father, the John Keats hybrid, that the core consisted of three warring camps. The Ultimates, obsessed with creating their own god, the ultimate intelligence. The Volatiles, who wished to eliminate humanity and get on with their own goals. And the Stables, who wished to maintain the status quo vis-à-vis humankind. This explanation was an absolute lie. There were not and are not three camps in the Technocore. There are billions. The core is the ultimate exercise in anarchy. Hyper-parasitism carried to its highest power. Core elements vie for power in alliances which might last centuries or microseconds. Billions of the parasitic personae ebb and flow in unholy alliances built to control or predict events. You see, core personae refuse to die unless they are forced to. Maynard Gladstone's death bomb attack on the Farcaster medium not only caused the fall of the Farcasters, it killed billions of would-be immortal core personae. But the individuals refused to make way for others without a fight. Yet at the same time, the core hyperlife needs death for its own evolution. But death in the core universe has its own agenda. The Reaper program, which Tom Ray created more than 1,000 years ago, still exists in the core medium, mutated to 1,000,000 alternate forms. Uman never mentioned the Reapers as a core faction, but they represent a far greater block than the Ultimates. It was the Reapers who created and first controlled the physical construct known as the Shrike. It's an interesting footnote that those core personae which survive the Reapers do so not just through parasitism, but through a necrophilic parasitism. This is the technique by which the original 22-byte artificial life forms managed to evolve and survive in Tom Ray's virtual evolution machine so many centuries ago, by stealing the scattered copy code of other byte creatures who were reaped in the midst of reproducing. The core parasites not only have sex, they have sex with the dead. This is how millions of the mutated core personae survive today, by necrophilic hyperparasitism. What does the core want from humankind now? Why has it revitalized the Catholic Church and allowed the Pax to come into existence? How do the cruciforms work, and how do they serve the core? How do the so-called Gideon Drive Archangel ships really work, and what is their effect on the void which binds? And how is the core dealing with the threat of the lions and tigers and bears? These things we shall discuss another time. It is the day after we learn of the coming of the Pax, and I am working stone on the highest scaffolds. During the first days after my arrival, I think that Rachel, Theo, Jigme Norbu, George Sarong, and the others were doubtful if I could earn my keep on the construction site at Swan Kung Su. I admit that I had doubts of my own as I watched the hard work and skill on view here. But after a few days of literally learning the ropes of gear and climbing protocols on the rock faces, ledges, cables, scaffolds, and slideways in the area, I volunteered for work duty and was given a chance to fail. I did not fail. Aenea knew of my apprenticeship with Avril Hume, not only landscaping the huge Beak estates, but working stone and wood for follies and bridges, gazebos and towers. That work served me well here, and within 2 weeks I had graduated from a basic scaffolding crew to the select group of high riggers and stone workers laboring on the highest platforms. Aenea's design allowed for the highest structures to rise to the great rock overhang, and for various walkways and parapets actually to be incorporated into that stone. This is what we are working on now, chiseling stone and laying brick for the walkway along the edge of nothing, our scaffolds perilously cantilevered far out over the drop. In the past 3 months, my body has grown leaner and stronger, my reaction time quicker, and my judgment more careful as I work on sheer rock walls and slippery bonsai bamboo. Lomo Dondrub, the skilled flyer and climber, has volunteered to free-climb the end of the overhang here to set anchor points for the final meters of the scaffolding, and for the last hour, Vicky Groselj, Kim Byung-soon, Haruyuki Otaki, Kenshiro Endo, Chang-chi Kenchung, Labsang Samten, a few of the other brick workers, masons, high riggers, and I have been watching as Lomo moves across the rock above the overhang without protection, moving like the proverbial old earth fly, his powerful arms and legs flexing under the thin material of his climbing garb. 3 points in touch with the slick, more than vertical stone at all times, while his free hand or foot feels for the slightest rough spot on which to rest, the smallest fissure or crack in which to work a bolt for our anchor. It is terrifying to watch him, but also a privilege, as if we were able to go back in a time machine to watch Picasso paint or George Wu read poetry or Mena Gladstone give a speech. 12 times I am sure that Lomo is going to peel off and fall. It would take minutes for him to free fall into the poison clouds below, but each time he magically holds his place, or finds a friction point, or miraculously discovers a crack into which he can wedge a hand or finger to support his entire body. Finally, he is done. The lines are anchored and dangling, the cable points are secured, and Lomo slides down to his early fixed point, traverses 5 meters laterally, drops into the stirrups of the overhang gear, and swings onto our work platform like some legendary superhero coming in for a landing. Lapsang Samten hands him an icy mug of rice beer. Kenshiro and Vicky pound him on the back. Chang-chi Kenchung, our master carpenter with the waxed mustaches, breaks into a bawdy song of praise. I shake my head and grin like an idiot. The day is exhilarating. A dome of blue sky, the sacred mountain of the north, Hangshan, gleaming brightly across the cloud gap, and the winds moderate. Ania tells me that the rainy season will descend on us within days. A monsoon from the south bringing months of rain, slick rock, and eventual snow. But that seems unlikely and distant on such a perfect day as this. There is a touch at my elbow, and Ania is there. She has been out on the scaffolding most of the morning, or hanging from her harness on the worked rock face, supervising the stone and brickwork on the walkway and parapets. I am still grinning from the vicarious adrenaline rush of watching Lomo. "Cables are ready to be rigged," I say. "Three or four more good days and the wooden walkway will be done here. Then your final platform there." I point to the ultimate edge of the overhang. "And voila! Your project's done except for the painting and polishing, kiddo." Ania nods, but it is obvious that her mind is not on the celebration around Lomo or the imminent completion of her year of work. "Can you come walk with me a minute, Rawl?" I follow her down the scaffolding ladders, onto one of the permanent levels and out a stone ledge. Small green birds take wing from a fissure as we pass. From this angle, the temple hanging in air is a work of art. The painted woodwork gleams rather than glows its dark red. The staircases and railings and fretwork are elegant and complex. Many of the pagodas have their shoji walls slid open, and prayer flags and bedclothes flutter in the warm breeze. There are 8 lovely shrines in the temple, in ascending order along the rising walkways, each pagoda shrine representing a step in the noble 8-fold path as identified by the Buddha. The shrines line up on 3 axes relating to the 3 sections of the path: wisdom, morality, and meditation. On the ascending wisdom axis of staircases and platforms are the meditation shrines for right understanding and right thought. On the morality axis are right speech, right action, right livelihood, and right effort. These last meditation shrines can be reached only by hard climbing on a ladder rather than staircase because, as Ania and Kempo Nga Wang Tashi explained to me one evening early in my stay, the Buddha had meant for his path to be one of strenuous and unremitting commitment. The highest meditation pagodas are given over to contemplation of the last 2 steps on the noble 8-fold path: right mindfulness and right meditation. This final pagoda, I had noticed immediately, looks out only onto the stone wall of the cliff face. I also had noticed that there were no statues of Buddha in the temple. The little that Grandam had explained to me about Buddhism when I'd asked as a child, having run across a reference in an old book from the Moore's End Library, was that Buddhists revered and prayed to statues in the likeness of the Buddha. "Where were they?" I had asked Ania. She had explained that on old earth, Buddhist thought had been grouped into 2 major categories: Hinayana, an older school of thought given the pejorative term meaning lesser vehicle, as in salvation, by the more popular schools of the Mahayana, or the self-proclaimed greater vehicle. There had once been 18 schools of Hinayana teaching, all of which had dealt with Buddha as a teacher and urged contemplation and study of his teachings, rather than worship of him. But by the time of the big mistake, only one of those schools survived, the Theravada. And that only in remote sections of disease and famine-ravaged Sri Lanka and Thailand, 2 political provinces of old earth. All the other Buddhist schools carried away on the Hajira had belonged to the Mahayana category, which focused on veneration of Buddhist statuary, meditation for salvation, saffron robes, and the other trappings that Grandam had described to me. But, Ania had explained, on Tian Shan, the most Buddhist-influenced world in the outback or old hegemony, Buddhism had evolved backward toward rationality, contemplation, study, and careful, open-minded analysis of Buddha's teaching. Thus there were no statues to the Buddha at Swan Kung Su. We stop walking at the end of this stone ledge. Birds soar and cycle below us, waiting for us to leave so that they can return to their fisher nests. What is it, kiddo?
The reception at the Winter Palace in Potala is tomorrow night, she says. Her face is flushed and dusty from her morning's work on the high scaffolds. I notice that she has scraped a rough line above her brow, and that there are a few tiny crimson drops of blood. Charles Chikyap Kempo is putting together an official party, numbering no more than 10 to attend, she continues. Kempo Nga Wa Tashi will be in it, of course, as will overseer Tsipon Shakaba, the Dalai Lama's cousin, Giallo, his brother Lapsang, Lomo Dondrub, because the Dalai Lama's heard of his feat and would like to meet him, Tromo Trochi of Domu as trade agent, and one of the foremen to represent the workers, either George or Jigme.
I can't imagine one without the other, I say.
I can't either, says Ania. But I think it will have to be George. He talks. Perhaps Jigme will walk there with us and wait outside the palace.
That's 8, I say.
Ania takes my hand. Her fingers are roughened by work and abrasion, but are still, I think, the softest and most elegant human digits in the known universe. I'm 9, she says. There's going to be a huge crowd there, parties from all the towns and provinces in the hemisphere. The odds are that we won't get within 20 meters of anyone from the PAX.
Or that we'll be the first to be introduced, I say. Murphy's Law and all that.
Yeah, says Ania. And the smile I see is exactly the one I had seen on the face of my 11-year-old friend, when something mischievous and perhaps a bit dangerous was afoot. Want to go as my date? I let out a breath.
I wouldn't miss it for the world, I say. Chapter 18. On the night before the Dalai Lama's reception, I am tired but I cannot sleep. A. Bedek is away, staying at Joe Kung with George and Jigme, and the 30 loads of construction material that should have come in yesterday, but that were held up in the Fisher City by a porter strike. A. Bedek will hire new porters in the morning and lead the procession the last few kilometers to the temple. Restless, I roll off my futon and slip into whipcord trousers, a faded shirt, my boots, and the light therm jacket. When I step out of my sleeping pagoda, I notice lantern light warming the opaque windows and shoji door of Ania's pagoda. She is working late again. Walking softly so as not to disturb her by rocking the platform, I clamber down a ladder to the main level of the temple hanging in air. It always amazes me how empty this place is at night. At first I thought it was the result of the construction workers, most of whom live in the cliffside crates around Jokung, being gone. But I've come to realize how few people spend their nights in the temple complex. George and Jigme usually sleep in their foreman's shack, but are in Jokung with A. Bedek tonight. The abbot Kempo Nga Wang Tashi stays with the monks some nights, but this night he has returned to his formal home in Jokung. A handful of monks prefer their austere quarters here to the formal monastery in Jokung, including Chim Din, Lapsang Samten, and the woman Donka Nyapso. Occasionally the flyer, Lomo, stays at the monks' quarters or in an empty shrine here, but not tonight. Lomo has left early for the Winter Palace, having mentioned his thought of climbing Nanda Devi south of Potala. So while I can see a soft lantern glow coming from the monks' quarters hundreds of meters away on the lowest level of the eastern edge of the complex, a glow that is extinguished even as I watch it, the rest of the temple complex is dark and quiet in the starlight. Neither the oracle nor the other bright moons have risen yet, although the eastern horizon is beginning to glow a bit with their coming. The stars are incredibly bright, almost as brilliant and unwavering as when seen from space. There are thousands visible this night, more than I remembered from Hyperion's or old Earth's night sky, and I crane my neck until I can see the slowly moving star that is the tiny moon where the ship is presumably hiding. I am carrying the comm unit Disky journal, and all it would take is a whisper to query the ship, but Ania and I have decided that with the pack so near, even tight beam transmissions to or from the ship should be reserved for emergency situations. I sincerely hope that no emergency situations will arise soon.
taking the ladders, staircases, and short bridges down the west side of the temple complex. I walk back along the brick and stone ledge beneath the lowest structures. The night wind has come up, and I can hear the crack and groan of the wooden timbers as entire platform levels adjust themselves to the wind and chill. Prayer flags flap above me, and I see starlight on the cloud tops, where they curl against the ridge rock so far below. The wind is not quite strong enough to make the distinctive wolf's howl that woke me my first few nights here, but its passage through the fissures and timbers and cracks sets the world muttering and whispering around me. I reach the wisdom staircase and climb up through the right understanding meditation pavilion, standing a moment at the balcony to look out at the dark and silent monk's quarters perched by itself on a boulder to the east. I recognize the infinite wood-carving skill and care of the sisters, Kuku and Keisei, and the elaborate carvings just under my fingertips here. Wrapping my jacket tighter in the rising wind, I climb the spiral staircase to the platform pagoda for right thought. On the east wall of this restored pagoda, Ania has designed a large, perfectly round window, looking east toward the dip in the ridgeline there, where the oracle makes its first appearance. And the moon is rising now, its bright rays illuminating first the ceiling of this pagoda and then the rear wall, where these words from the Sutta Nipata scripture are set into the plaster wall. As a flame blown out by the wind goes to rest and cannot be defined, so the wise man freed from individuality goes to rest and cannot be defined. Gone beyond all images. Gone beyond the power of words. I know that this passage deals with the enigmatic death of Buddha, but I read it in the moonlight with the thought of how it might apply to Ania or myself or the two of us. It does not seem to apply. Unlike the monks who labor here for enlightenment, I have no urge whatsoever to go beyond individuality. The world itself, all of the myriad worlds I have been privileged to see and walk upon, are what fascinate and delight me. I have no wish to put the world and my sense images of the world behind me. And I know that Ania feels the same about life, that involvement with it is like the Catholic communion. Only the world is the host and it must be chewed. Still, the thought of the essence of things, of people, of life going beyond all images and the power of words, this resonates with me. I have been trying and failing to put even the essence of this place, these days, into words and discovering the futility of it. Leaving the wisdom axis, I cross the long platform for cooking and common meals and begin up the morality axis of stairways, bridges, and platforms. The oracle is free of the ridgeline now, and the light from it and its two attendants paint the rock and red wood around me in thick moon paint. I pass through the pavilions for right speech and right action, pausing to catch my breath in the circular pagoda for right livelihood. There is a bamboo barrel of drinking water just outside the pagoda for right effort, and I drink deeply there. Prayer flags flutter and snap along the terraces and eaves as I move softly across the long connecting platform to the highest structures. The meditation pavilion for right mindfulness is part of Ania's recent work and still smells of fresh bonsai cedar. 10 meters higher along the steep ladder, the right meditation pavilion perches out over the bulk of the temple, its window looking out on the ridge wall. I stand there for several minutes, realizing for the first time that the shadow of the pagoda itself falls upon that slab of rock when the moon is rising as it is now, and that Ania has designed the roof of the pavilion so that its shadow connects with natural clefts and discolorations in the rock to create a shadow character that I recognize as the Chinese character for Buddha. At this moment I am taken by a chill. Although the wind is not blowing any harder than it has been. Goosebumps rise along my forearms and the back of my neck feels cold. I realize, no, see, in that instant, that Ania's mission, whatever it is doomed to failure. She and I are both going to be captured, interrogated, probably tortured and executed. My promises to the old poet on Hyperion were so much wasted breath. Bring down the packs, I had said. The packs with its billions of faithful, millions of men and women in arms, thousands of warships. Bring back old Earth, I had agreed. Well, I had visited it. I look out the window to see the sky, but there is only the rock wall in the moonlight and the slowly cohering shadow character of the Buddha's name, the three vertical strokes like ink on slate-colored vellum, the three horizontal strokes flowing around and together, making three white faces in the negative spaces, three faces staring at me in the dark. I had promised to protect Ania. I vow that I will die doing that. Shaking off the chill and the premonition, I go out onto the meditation platform, clip to a cable, and hum 30 meters across the void to the platform below the top terrace, where Ania and I have sleeping pagodas. As I climb the last ladder to the highest level, I am thinking, perhaps I will sleep now. I made no notes on this in the Disky journal. I remember it now as I write it. Ania's light was out. I was pleased. She stayed up too late, worked too hard. The high work scaffolds and cliff cables were no place for an exhausted architect. I stepped into my own shack, slid shut the shoji door, and kicked off my boots. Things were as I had left them. The outer screen wall slid back a bit, moonlight bright across my sleeping mat, the wind rattling the walls in its soft conversation with the mountains. Neither of my lanterns was lit, but I had the light from the moon and my memory of the small room in the dark. The floor was bare tatami except for my sleeping futon and a single chest near the door that held my rucksack, few food items, beer mug, the rebreathers I'd brought from the ship, and my climbing gear. There was nothing to trip over. I hung my jacket on the hook near the door, splashed water on my face from the basin in the chest, and stripped off my shirt, socks, trousers, and underwear, stuffing them into the ditty bag in the chest. Tomorrow was laundry day. Sighing, feeling the premonition of doom I'd felt in the meditation pavilion now fading into simple fatigue, I walked over to the sleeping mat. I have always slept naked, except for when in the home guard and during my trip in the consul's ship with my two friends. There was the slightest of movements in the darkness beyond the bright strip of moonlight, and, startled, I dropped into a fighting crouch. Nakedness makes one feel more vulnerable than usual. Then I realized, a Bedick must have returned early. I unclenched my right fist. "Rawl?" said Ania. She leaned forward into the moonlight. She had wrapped my sleeping blanket around the lower part of her body, but her shoulders and breasts and abdomen were bare. The oracle touched her hair and cheekbones with soft light. I opened my mouth to speak, started to turn back toward my clothes or jacket, decided not to walk that far, and dropped on one knee to the sleeping mat, pulling up the futon's sheet to cover myself. I was not a prude, but this was Ania. What was she? "Rawl," she said again. And this time there was no question in her voice. She moved closer to me on her knees. The blanket fell away from her. "Ania," I said stupidly. "Ania, you don't really..." She set her finger on my lips and removed it a second later. But before I could speak, she leaned closer and pressed her lips where her finger had been. Every time I had ever touched my young friend, the contact had been electric. I have described this before and always felt foolish discussing it, but I ascribed it to her, an aura, a charge of personality. It was real, not a metaphor. But never had I felt the surge of electricity between us as in this instant. For a second, I was passive, receiving the kiss rather than sharing in it. But then the warmth and insistence of it overcame thought, overcame doubt, overcame all of my other senses in every nuance of the word. And then I was returning her kiss, putting my arms around her to pull her closer, even as she slid her arms under mine and ran strong fingers up my back. More than 5 years ago for her, when she had kissed me farewell at the river on old Earth, Her kiss had been urgent, electric, filled with questions and messages, but still a 16-year-old girl's kiss. This kiss was the warm, moist, open touch of a woman, and I responded to it in an instant. We kissed for an eternity. I was vaguely aware of my own nudity and excitement as something I should be concerned about, embarrassed about. But it was a distant thing, secondary to the expanding warmth and urgency of the kisses that would not stop. When finally our lips came apart, feeling swollen, almost bruised, wanting to be kissed again, we kissed each other's cheeks, eyelids, forehead, ears. I lowered my face and kissed the hollow of her throat, feeling the pulse against my lips there and inhaling the perfumed scent of her skin. She moved forward on her knees, arching her back slightly so that her breasts touched my cheek. I cupped one and kissed the nipple almost reverently. Ania cupped the back of my head in her palm. I could feel her breath on me quickening as she bowed her face toward me. "Wait. Wait," I said, pulling my face up and leaning back. "No, Ania, are you... I mean, I don't think..." "Shh," she said, leaning over me again, kissing me again, pulling back so that her dark eyes seemed to fill the world. "Shh, Rawl. Yes." She kissed me again, leaning to her right so that we both reclined on the sleeping mat, still kissing, the rising breeze rattling the rice paper walls, the entire platform rocking to the depth of our kiss and the motion of our bodies. It is a problem to tell of such things, to share the most private and sacred of moments. It feels like a violation to put such things into words, and a lie not to. To see and feel one's beloved naked for the first time is one of life's pure, irreducible epiphanies. If there is a true religion in the universe, it must include that truth of contact or be forever hollow. To make love to the one true person who deserves that love is one of the few absolute rewards of being a human being, balancing all of the pain, loss, awkwardness, loneliness, idiocy, compromise, and clumsiness that go with the human condition. To make love to the right person makes up for a lot of mistakes. I had never made love to the right person before. I knew that, even as Ania and I first kissed and lay against each other, even before we began moving slowly, then quickly, then slowly again. I realized that I had never really made love to anyone before. That the young soldier on leave sex with friendly women, or the bargeman and bargewoman we have the opportunity, so why not sex, that I had thought, explored, and discovered everything to do with the subject was not even the beginning. This was the beginning. I remember Ania rising above me at one point, her hand hard on my chest, her own chest slick with sweat. But she was still looking at me. Looking at me so intensely and so warmly that it was as if we were connected intimately by our gaze as surely as by our thighs and genitals. And I was to remember that instant every time we made love in the future, even as I seemed to be remembering forward to all those future times, even during these first few moments of our intimacy. Lying together in the moonlight, the sheets and blankets and the futon curled and thrown around us, the cool wind from the north drying the sweat on our bodies, her cheek on my chest and my thigh across her hip. We kept touching each other, her fingers playing with the hair on my chest, my fingers tracing the line of her cheek, the sole of my foot sliding up and down the back of her leg, curling around her strong calf muscles. "Was this a mistake?" I whispered. "No," she whispered back. "Unless..." My heart pounded. "Unless what?" "Unless you didn't get those shots in the home guard that I'm sure you got," she whispered. I was so anxious that I did not hear the teasing quality in her voice. "What? Shots? What?" I said, rolling onto my elbow. "Oh, shots. Shit, you know I did, Jesus. I know you did, whispered Aenea, and I could hear the smile now. When we Hyperion lads had joined the home guard, the authorities had given us the usual battery of PAX-approved injections. Anti-malaria, anti-cancer, antivirus, and birth control. In a PAX universe where the vast majority of individuals chose the cruciform, chose to attempt to be immortal, birth control was a given. One could apply to PAX authorities for the antidote after marriage or simply buy it on the black market when it was time to start a family. Or if one chose neither the way of the cross nor a family, it would last until old age or death made the issue moot. I had not thought of that shot for years. Actually, I think Abedic had asked me about those shots on the consul's ship a decade ago when we were discussing preventative medicine and I had mentioned the home guard induction battery. Our young friend of 11 or 12 curled on a couch there on the hollow pit level, reading a book from the ship's library, seemingly not paying attention at all. No, I said, still on my elbow. I mean a mistake. You're... me, she whispered. 21 standard years old, I finished. I'm... you, she whispered. 11 standard years older than that. Incredible, said Aenea. Her whole face was in the moonlight as she looked up at me. You can do math. At such a moment. I sighed and rolled over on my stomach. The sheets smelled of us. The wind was still rising, and now it rattled the walls. I'm cold, whispered Aenea. In the days and months to come, I would have held her in my arms if she said such a thing. But that night I responded literally and stood to slide shut the shoji screen. The wind was colder than usual. No, she said.
What?
Don't close it all the way. She was sitting up, with the sheet raised to just below her breasts. But it's... the moonlight on you, Aenea whispered. Her voice may have caused my physical response, or the sight of her waiting for me in the blankets. Besides holding in our own scents, the room smelled like fresh straw because of the new tatami and the ryokan in the ceiling, and of the fresh, cool air of the mountains. But the cold breeze did not slow my reaction to her. Come here, she whispered, and opened the blanket like a cape to fold me in. The next morning, and I am working on setting the overhang walkway in place, and it is as if I am sleepwalking. Part of the problem is lack of sleep. The oracle had said, and the east was paling with morning when Aenea slipped back to her own pavilion. But the major reason is sheer, simple stupefaction. Life has taken a turn that I had never anticipated, never imagined. I am setting supports into the cliff for the high walk with the high riggers Haruyuki, Kenshiro, and Wojtek Meyer moving ahead, drilling holes in the stone, while Kim Byung-soon and Vicky Grosselge lay brick behind and beneath us, and carpenter Chang-chi Kenchung begins work behind me on the laying of the wood floor of the terrace itself. There would be nothing to catch the high riggers and me if we fall from the wooden beams, if Lomo had not done his free-climbing exhibition yesterday and set fixed ropes and cables in place. Now, as we jump from beam to beam, we just clip one of our harness carabiners into place on the next rope. I have fallen before and had the fall arrested by this sort of fixed rope. Each can hold 5 times my weight. Now I leap from set beam to set beam, pulling along the next beam as it dangles from one of the cables. The wind is coming up and threatens to hurl me off into space, but I balance myself with one hand touching the hanging beam and 3 fingers on the rock face itself. I reach the end of the 3rd fixed rope, unclip and prepare to clip onto the 4th of 7 lines Lomo has rigged. I do not know what to think about last night. That is, I know how I feel. Exhilarated, confused, ecstatic, in love. But I don't know how to think about it. I tried to intercept Aenea before breakfast in the communal dining pavilion near the monks' quarters, but she had already eaten and headed far out to where the terrace carvers had run into trouble on the new eastern walkway.
Then A. Bedick, George Sarong, and Jigme Norbu had shown up with the porters, and an hour or two was consumed sorting materials and transporting the beams, chisels, lumber, and other items to the new high scaffolds. I had headed out onto the eastern ledge before the beam work began, but A. Bedick and Sipon Shakapa were conferring with Ania, so I jogged back to the scaffolds and got busy. Now I was jumping to the last beam set in place this morning, ready to install the next one in the hole Haruyuki and Kenshiro have chiseled and blasted into the rock with tiny shaped charges. Then Wojtek and Vicky will cement the post in place. Within 30 minutes, it will be firm enough for Chang-Chi to set a work platform on. I've become accustomed to leaping from beam to beam, catching my balance and squatting to set the next beam in place. And I do so now on the last beam, pinwheeling my left arm to keep my balance while my fingers stay in contact with the beam balancing from the cable. Suddenly, the beam swings out too far ahead of me, and I am off balance, leaning into nothing. I know that the safety line will catch me, but I hate to fall and be dangling here between the last beam and the newly drilled hole. If I don't have enough momentum to kick back to the beam, I'll have to wait for Kenshiro or one of the other riggers to kick out and rescue me. In a fraction of a second, I make up my mind and jump, catching the swinging beam and kicking out hard. Because the safety rope has several meters of slack before it will catch me, all of my weight is on my fingers now. The beam is too thick for me to get a good grip on it, and I can feel my fingers sliding on the iron hard wood. But rather than go dropping to the elastic end of my fixed line, I struggle to hang on, succeed in swinging the heavy post back toward the last beam in place, and jump the last 2 meters, landing on the slippery beam and flailing my arms for balance. Laughing at my own foolishness, I catch my balance and stand panting for a moment, watching the clouds boiling against the rock several thousand meters below my feet. Chang-Chi Kenshung is leaping from beam to beam toward me, clipping onto the fixed ropes with a rapid urgency. There is something like horror in his eyes, and for a second I am sure that something has happened to Ania. My heart begins beating so hard, and anxiety washes over me so swiftly that I almost lose my balance. But I catch it again and stand balancing on the last fixed beam, waiting for Chang-Chi with a sense of dread. When he leaps to the last beam with me, Chang-Chi is too winded to speak. He gestures toward me urgently, but I do not understand the motion. Perhaps he has seen my comical swing and dance and leap with the dangling beam and was concerned. To show him that it was all right, I reach up to my harness line to show him that the carabiner is locked tight to the safety line. There is no carabiner there. I never tied on to the last fixed rope. I have been doing all this leaping, balancing, hanging, and jumping with no safety line. There has been nothing between me and... Feeling a sudden stab of vertigo and nausea, I stagger 3 steps to the cliff wall and lean against the cold stone. The overhang tries to push me away, and it is as if the entire mountain is tilting outward, pushing me off the beam. Chang-Chi tugs Lomo's fixed line around, lifts a beaner from my harness rack and clips me on. I nod my appreciation and try not to lose my breakfast while he is here with me. 10 meters around the bend in the cliff, Haruyuki and Kenshiro are gesturing. They have blasted another perfect hole. They want me to catch up with setting the beams in place. The party departing for the Dalai Lama's evening reception for the PAX at Patala leaves just after the noon meal in the common dining hall. I see Ania there, but except for a meaningful exchange of glances and a smile from her that makes my knees weak, we have no private communication. We assemble on the lowest level with hundreds of workers, monks, cooks, scholars, and porters waving and cheering from the platforms above. Rain clouds are beginning to curl and spill between the low gaps in the eastern ridgeline. But the sky above Suan Kung Su is still blue, and the red prayer flags flapping from the high terraces stand out with almost